One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is Leslie Kane, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined on today's show by a founding board member and executive board member for SCU, which is the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. He was the director of research at MUFON from 2007 to 2017, also creating their science review board in 2012, an author with almost two decades of research into this topic behind him, including numerous papers published. He's also an engineer with a bachelor's degree in chemistry. I'd love to welcome to the podcast Mr. Robert Powell. Robert, how are you?
Hi, Andy. It's nice to be on your podcast.
Listen, it's good to finally get you on. Lots of interest as well from the listeners when I first announced you were coming on a good few weeks ago now. Good to be here. Let's get lots to talk about. So, Robert, let's start right back at the beginning for you. What were your sort of earliest memories or earliest interest in the UFO topic?
I first became interested when I was a teenager. I read J. Allen Hynek's book, The UFO Experience. And so that kind of caught my attention. But at the time, you know, high school was there, college afterwards, then you get married, raise a family. So I didn't have time for UFOs until after I retired early. So at about the age of 53, I started studying on the UFO subject. And that's been 17 years now. So it definitely has captured my attention.
So quite a passive interest before then, to say, not something you ridiculed or stigmatized, but it was just there. It wasn't a thing for you in your life. Is that fair enough?
That's very fair. It was not, it was just a passive interest. And when I left American business, basically, I said, okay, what are the things I want to do in life? So I started listing them. And one that I had was go back and read more about UFOs. And as I studied it more and read more about it, it really captured my attention to the point that I said, there is something really to this. And that's what got me started on it.
What stuck with you? Because that's a long time for a hobby to lay dormant in the background. And I wonder, had you ever had any sightings of your own at all growing up, knew anyone with an interest, or was it literally just that one day the opportunity was there for some free time in your life and it took the mantle?
You know, that's a very good question. What stuck with me? No one's actually asked me that specific question. You know, I think what it was is I was, remember the Australian case, the guy that flew his airplane and you could hear the sound of metal crunching and then he disappears.
It was Frederick Valentich.
Right. And so I kept that newspaper article in the book, The UFO Experience. And that really is maybe what stuck with me and made me, you know, reopen the book and look at UFOs again was that case. That I found very, grasped my attention.
And I'm trying to remember the basics for anyone who hasn't heard of it. Usually it's listed as the disappearance of Frederick Valentich, young pilot, rented a private aircraft off of the mainland of Australia, flying to King's Island, I think it was somewhere.
Yeah.
And Tasmania, round about there, yeah.
Yeah, Tasmania, and right.
There was two stories. One, he was going to pick up friends, but there was never any friends there to collect. The other, he was going to pick up King Crab, something like that. And like you say, really interestingly, crossing this body of water, he reported an object following him. This thing was above him. And then it sounds or looks like there was an abduction or capturing of the craft, potentially. His body was never recovered, neither was the flight. There was some debris sometime later, quite far away, but it had all the hallmarks of an early UFO abduction case, and that's one that stuck with you, yeah?
Yeah, so that's... and so that was, 2006 is when I started... investigating the UFO subject. And what I did is I joined an organization known as MUFON. And at the time that I joined, within 2 months probably, they had an opening for a director of research. And so I sent them my resume and they accepted me as their director of research. And I stayed at MUFON about 10 years. And I've read probably thousands of cases while I was at MUFON and investigated some very interesting cases. But finally, I reached a point where I just didn't feel there was enough science to move on. And so myself and two other individuals founded the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies in September of 2017. So the organization's now almost 7 years old.
And I've had Rich Hoffman on the podcast and previously, hopefully get Richard back on in the near future to speak to him. Wonderful gentleman to speak with, really knowledgeable, really enthusiastic, wonderful bow ties as well.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you if he had his bow tie on.
I'm almost certain he had his bow tie on when we spoke, unless if I think of Richard, I think bow tie. So I might be misremembering, but I'm pretty sure he had the bow tie on.
Yeah, I bet he did.
Let's take you back to MUFON before we jump into the SCU. So you've gone from a pretty, like you say, no real involvement in the UFO topic, finding MUFON, going, do you know what, let's get into this. Within 2 months, you're really heavily involved. What are those initial months like? And is it what you expected getting involved in a kind of UFO organization? What do you remember?
Well, the things that I guess struck me, right, because I had come out of the semiconductor industry, was just how most of the people didn't really have science backgrounds. No one really understood the basics of the science behind it, right? And so it was more of enthrallment with the fact, okay, a UFO came by or didn't come by or what have you. So that was my first feeling is when I was in the MUFON organization. In January of 2008, so I had only been in the organization a little over 1 year, there was an event that happened in Stephenville, Texas. And we received within, 24 hours, several dozen reports of UFOs from within the same geographic area and within a very similar period of time. And that was my first exposure to what you might call a localized UFO flap. And my initial reaction was, okay, let's get there now, get there yesterday, needed to be done immediately. But there was like politics involved. So it was almost a week and a half before we actually got to the site, which was not the way I felt it. A important case like that should be investigated.
And can I just ask, is that frustrating as for the scientist in you, that when you want to go there, investigate, find out what's happening, any number of things can disappear, go away, be tampered with within that kind of time frame? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, that's the science part in me that I don't like. And it's important to get to a witness before the media gets to a witness, because, you know, just the questions that are asked can cause slight changes in someone's memory. Right. Mm-hmm. And I saw that actually in the Stephenville case, which I investigated. And it actually turned out to be one of the best cases, I think, that's occurred in the last 20 years.
Am I right that you wrote quite a substantial paper on the Stephenville lights?
Right. About a 95-page report. And we obtained radar data. And what was great about the Stephenville case was, first, I interviewed the witnesses. And I interviewed them at their place of residence where they saw the object. And then I asked for the radar data from the FAA. And when I got the radar data, I was able to match up actual radar imagery with what the witnesses reported, which I found, you know, that was fantastic to have that actually happen. And probably the best one was a constable who had seen this object and described it as flying to the northeast at an extreme rate of speed. Well, at the exact time that he said that happened, and to the northeast, the radar picks up an object moving at 1,900 miles per hour, and from basically standing still to 1,900 miles an hour. And that, in terms of G-forces, that's 8 to 9 G-forces. And to give the audience a feel for that, if you weigh 150 pounds and you're sitting in your chair, that's 1 G-force. If you had 6 G-forces on you, you would feel like you weighed 900 pounds. And most people will become unconscious within a few seconds, and within a few minutes would be dead with that level of G-forces. And so that to have 9 G-forces, and that is what you might call linear acceleration, right? It's not like the object's curving and causing the G-forces. It's direct linear acceleration. And to give you a reference, an F-35, for example, the G-forces and linear acceleration is going to be around maybe 1.5 G-forces at the most, nowhere near 9 G-forces.
So that particular case for you as a scientist, yeah, it's got the intrigue and the interest for those involved in MUFON, but you can see corroborating data from radar, multiple witnesses. And we're going to talk about your book later. Your latest book from April is UFOs, A Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know. And we'll get to that. But one of the themes from that is how important anecdotal data can be. But that's not only had anecdotal data. You've got, you know, several witnesses.
Right.
You've got trained observers. You know, you've got constables, you know, credible witnesses. Some folks might say unfairly, you know, the public would see themselves as credible as well. And you've got this additional data. So for you, was that something that just whet your interest even more?
Yes, yes. The Stephenville case really got me excited on the UFO subject once that one had occurred. So, and I probably spent 6 months investigating that case. And a lot of that effort went into analyzing the radar data. Because, you know, to do it scientifically, the first thing you do is not jump to go look for the UFOs. The first thing you do is say, I want to establish that I can use this radar data. So there were F-16s involved. So the first thing I did was track the F-16s flying through Texas airspace, because that way I knew that I could track an object and follow it, determine its speed, etc. So once I'd done that with the F-16s, then I looked for what the witnesses said and looked for unknown objects near them.
And just for people listening, I was going to say witnesses, for those listening who might not be familiar, what was your conclusion then? Because 6 months is a long investigation. Your average Joe on the street is going to ask you, so was it aliens? I think for those more involved and invested in the topic, we know that's not a simple question to answer. So what did you conclude?
Well, the conclusion I had was that I was able to corroborate what the witnesses saw. And based on the radar data, whatever the object was, I could not explain it with any terrestrial aircraft that were known at the time. So I could not explain it with a helicopter, a jet, or anything else.
Obviously, MUFON is not a cash-rich organization. You don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars of your own money, I'm presuming, to go and spend on following that up. But what would those next steps have been? Say you did have a funding for that at the time. What would you have liked to have done further to try and get more data or more information?
Oh, that's a good question. I actually think we did all we could in terms of getting information on that case. I'm not sure in that particular incident that more money would have gotten us any more information than what we had.
I think that's an important thing to remember then, that sometimes you can take a case as far as you can with that information based on the data available. And from there, it just has to be filed as unknown. Is that fair to say?
Right. Yeah. I think that's fair to say is just unknown. And you know, Andy, if the Stephenville case was just isolated, right, where you have radar data that indicates an object is traveling in a manner that you can't explain with any terrestrial aircraft. If that was isolated, then I would say, well, I don't know what, you know, just one of those strange things that happened, right? But when you start getting multiple cases like that over and over, it's hard to just throw it away and say, oh, I don't have an explanation. I don't know what it is. At this point, I've seen enough cases that I'm convinced that whatever it is, it's not man-made, and it has capabilities far in advance of anything that we have.
So was it then your experiences with MUFON and maybe the frustrated scientists within you that led you then to go off and co-found the SCU?
Yes, absolutely. That's why we co-founded the SCU. And today, the SCU has almost 320 members. Almost 30% of our membership are PhDs, and most of them have science backgrounds. And you know, what's important with that information is that it tells the general public that there are people in the scientific community that believe this subject is worthy of investigation. So that there are a lot of scientists that think this should be investigated.
And is that the struggle for you? Because I'm guessing when you've got a credible, serious organization like SCU, you would go after things like grants or funding to try and do your work and do it to the best of your abilities. I take it you come up against that brick wall of stigma, even as a scientist, an academic, yeah?
Yes, yeah. There's still that stigma there. For example, if you try to publish a paper and it has the word UAP or UFO in it, it makes it very difficult to get that paper published, even if you follow all the basic scientific tenets in that paper.
So what have been some of your key wins and your highlights from your time involved with SCU?
Probably the incident 2004 with the USS Nimitz, USS Princeton, and the F-18s. We wrote a 220-page monogram on it. And from that monogram, we actually wrote a paper that was published in a journal known as Entropy. And that paper basically looked at acceleration characteristics that we saw in that incident.
And let's go back over that. For those that might not have twigged, it's the Tic Tac incident from 2004. You've got the Nimitz, you've got the Princeton, we've got the now infamous Tic Tacs. For those on YouTube, can see the little logo behind me just here. And for you as a scientist, again, let's talk about myself representing your average person interested in UFOs. We hear about these multiple objects, craft of some sort, military personnel witness them not over a day, but over weeks. These things are on radar, multiple ships, multiple sightings. They're captured with gun footage. The acceleration as a scientist, that's something for you that's measurable, and that's what gets your interest and attention, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the part that gets the attention of anyone, including myself, of course, is that you have this commander of a squadron who decides to go from 20,000 feet downwards to engage this object, and this object begins to move up towards him. I mean, that's exciting to anyone, you know, anyone in the public, anyone in the world of science, and that attracts a lot of attention. From the pure science, though, what is really interesting is within a four-hour period of time, we had three instances of high acceleration. Right? The first was the radar operators, Kevin Day and Gary Boris, who both indicated you had an object drop tens of thousands of feet in less than a second. That's an acceleration that is in hundreds of G-forces. So nothing that we have can even survive that, let alone have an occupant inside. I mean, a human being would just be turned to jello against the walls. That was the first case. The second, and probably the most important, was the four Navy pilots that said they see an object that's near them disappear in 2 seconds' time. Anytime any object can disappear from sight, and in 2 seconds, you're looking at acceleration rates that are extreme. So that was the second incident of high acceleration. And then the third was the video itself. So to have three cases of high acceleration in only 4 hours makes that, in my opinion, one of the best cases in history.
So I've got two questions for you then to begin with off the back of that. So from your point of view, what is the likelihood of anything being inside those objects? I think at the point I'm at, personally, with limited knowledge, it's almost likely those Tic Tacs are empty, at least of any being, biological or not, and there's some sort of drone, whether really advanced human technology or something other. What do you think, given the sheer speeds these objects are managing and the maneuvers they're performing as well?
Well, the speed and the maneuvering, even if there were no beings, you know, in it, and it was simply a drone, we are not capable of having anything move at that type of acceleration and not being destroyed. And furthermore, as the object moved, there was no heat generated. Like anything that moves through the atmosphere at speeds of 20,000 miles an hour, which is like Mach 15 or higher, it should be red hot and the metal would be melting. Hmm. And nothing like that happened. So clearly these objects are moving by some method that we don't fully understand. So as to whether or not there were beings, I suspect not, but it's still possible, right? Because whatever technology this is, if it can protect the equipment itself, then they could probably protect, a biological organism also within the object.
Apologies if you heard a siren going off there. I've got an ambulance passing by the shed to record the video. No, that's all right. The mic's working well then. I wonder also then, the second part of that question, it's one thing having those conversations with your colleagues, with those inside MUFON, SCU. If you go to an expo or a conference, you're going to have a really back and forward, interested, enthralling conversation. What do those conversations go like when you speak to fellow scientists, academics, engineers, and you entertain the notion of something traveling at Mach 15, not melting, not falling apart? How do those conversations sound from the other end?
Well, from the other end, it's like, well, that's not possible, right? Because we have no idea of how to do that. So, you do hit that wall. But then with certain individuals, you start to talk about, okay, how could that happen? You know, what are the possibilities, right? So it's almost like, there have been two areas that have been discussed. One is you have some type of warp field, right, where the object's not really in the atmosphere, and so it's protected. The other, and this one's maybe a little harder to understand, but it's, we have what we call inertia, which is the tendency of your body to sit there and not continue moving until a force acts on it. Well, you have what's called your basically inertia in a gravitational field, and then the inertia of the of the body itself. So imagine if you could lower your inertial weight to 0 grams, or basically no weight, to your craft. Well, if you're able to do that, right, then you can accelerate at a high speed very rapidly because there's nothing to push on. So I could take a beam of light and shine it on you, and you would accelerate to the speed of light rapidly because you have no weight. Now, the other thing that would happen is you could move through the atmosphere without interacting because you have no substance to interact with the atmosphere. So that is one of the theories that fits with what we see UAP do. Extreme acceleration, sudden changes in direction, and lack of interaction with the atmosphere. So it's almost as if the inertial weight of the object has changed.
You've explained that well enough that I can understand what you're getting at. So I'm sure the listeners and viewers will appreciate that. And I can appreciate having to have that conversation, especially when you've got a scientific mind. You're used to scientific language. You're almost having to reverse engineer your own conversation for someone to try and understand it. And I know I have the same thing, and I've said this before, Robert, to folks on the podcast. If I'm in work and I'm speaking to some of my colleagues and they'll talk about UFOs, and it's that, well, what if they're not from, you know, little green men from Mars? And you get their attention, or what if they're not coming from that far away? And you start to get to maybe they're here, you talk about the Tic Tacs, you can very quickly lose your average member of the public in the conversation just trying to have that. It's certainly not easy. Other organizations, of course, have since come along. Avi Loeb founded the Galileo Project a couple of years ago now, and he's working to put telescopes around the planet and look up out into the solar system and wider galaxy. You've got the Sol Foundation from Gary Nolan, Peter Scafish. How do you feel more organizations like this coming up are going to help move the conversation forward?
I think all of that helps because it helps bring academia into the question. Because I really feel the only way we get an answer is for academia to address the problem. We've spent 80 years with military organizations, at least within the United States. And I think actually that's also true probably in Britain. It's been military organizations that have examined the problem, and they've had zero success. And part of that is because national security is a key component of any military organization. And I think the only way we get an answer is we have to have openness. And so that means you have to go to academia and science rather than military organizations to really get an answer to what are UAP or UFOs.
I'm going to ask you to probably summarize quite a big question here. Take as long as you want to answer it. But I wonder, since 2017, we got that New York Times article, there's been a snowball which has gathered a lot of momentum, certainly slowing down at times, gathering speed at others, going through to congressional hearing, congressmen and women being involved in the conversation, David Grush coming forward, the Tic Tac story coming out. Where do you see the conversation right now? Are you impressed with the place it's at? Or do you think we could have made more progress?
I'm impressed with how far we've gone so far. One of the key things that most people who joined the SCU within the last 4 to 5 years have said is that the driver was the December 2017 New York Times article. So that's driving scientists to be interested in the subject, right? And I think it's because when you hear Navy pilots indicate that they engaged an object and they're flying towards the object and the object is flying towards them, it gives anybody a feeling that this is a serious, a real subject. The other thing that I think is driving all of this is it's not one that's as obvious as the December 2017 article. And that is that over the last 25 years, we have now discovered over 6,000 exoplanets. And these are planets around other star systems. So for the generation that's grown up today, this has always been. It's not like my generation, which at one point in time, we did not know if there were any planets around any other stars in the galaxy. And now we know that practically every star has planets. So I think that makes it easier to think that somewhere out there, there's probably a planet that has intelligent life and that they've probably figured out how to get across the galaxy. And so then it's not as difficult to surmise that there's a possibility that what we're looking at with UFOs are perhaps interstellar craft that have flown by our planet.
How likely do you think it is this, various different ways people see disclosure coming about, one of them, the more slow drip scientific route, is that the government play along, that they don't know much about this subject. The James Webb, for example, is taking all kinds of incredible images now and showing us even clearer pictures than what we had before, various nebula, planets, galaxies. So the likelihood of it finding something is much higher than we've ever had in the past. People think that maybe it's going to announce something in the coming months or year or two to say we've found signs of life, more than likely like biochemical and gases in an atmosphere, which then opens up the public's perception that, if I found something really far away, maybe there's something closer. Do you think that's quite a likely scenario, the way things are playing out?
I think it will happen very slowly and very gradually. So, for example, with the James Webb telescope and other telescopes that we send out into space, the first thing we will begin to detect are other molecules in another planet's atmosphere that tend to indicate there could be life, not that there is. And then as we get more and more advanced, at some point in the future, perhaps we will find, let's say, complex hydrocarbons in an atmosphere, right? So that's like what someone would see in our atmosphere. They would see plastics and other hydrocarbons, you know, in our atmosphere. And then maybe at some point in time, we get where we can cover the star so that we can see the planet directly. And we look at the dark side of a planet and we see that there's light being emitted from the dark side. Like if someone were looking at our planet, they would see incandescent light of a particular wavelength. And they would go, that's not natural. Someone is producing that, right? And so at that point in time, we would know that there is definitely an intelligence on a given extrasolar planet. That may be 50 years away. I don't know, you know, when that will happen. But I suspect at some point in time in the near future, probably people, young people that are watching this podcast today, it may happen in their lifetime.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way before. So if I'm correct, I know the general principle that right now we see or detect planets moving across other stars because it dips the star's light so we can tell something's moving across it. But we don't have the capability right now, like you say, to see what would be the back of that planet in any detail and tell if it has light emitting from it because of the brightness of the star. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah, the brightness of the star keeps us from doing that. Okay. But there's what's called a coronagraph that if you put like a James Webb type telescope out there and you block that planet's sun's light so that you can only see the planet, then you can detect much better what's in the atmosphere and if there are any light emissions coming from that planet.
No, I like that. And you mentioned, you know what, we're going to move on to speak about your book because I think it's relevant. You mentioned like the youngsters who may be listening or watching this. I know my son likes to tell people his dad's a podcaster. He's only 8, or YouTuber, as he calls me, which is frightening to think. He thinks it's cool, but at least someone does. You've written several books. We're going to talk about one of them, but there were two more. One of them is aimed at children, published in November 2020. The Truth About UFOs, A Scientific Perspective. Just quickly touch on that one for us as to why that was aimed at children, why that was important to you.
Yeah, so the book, The Truth About UFOs, it was written because of one of my grandkids. He was 9 years old, so about the age of your son. And he came to me with a book he had checked out at the library, and it was a book about alien abductions. And I told him, I said, no, do not read that book. That's not something you should be reading. So I said, I'll tell you what, I will write a book for you that you should read. So he took the book back to the library, and so I promised and wrote the book for him. And basically, the book is short. It's only 100 pages. I've got about a dozen interesting true cases that occurred. But I word the book so there's questions for kids, so that, like, if you were reading it with an 8 or 9 year old, they can ask you questions back, and then you can answer the questions. Whether someone believes in UFOs or not, it's a very good book for getting a child to think, you know, what is that? What are the possibilities? You know, do I believe this person? Do I not believe that person? You know, it really gets their mind to thinking. That's how I wrote that book.
I only found that one a few days ago when I was going through your Amazon just to double check a few details. And I noticed it was there. So I'm going to pick up a copy to give to my 8-year-old, because we're encouraging him to do a lot more reading at the moment. He watches a lot more YouTube and watches more football than that. Interesting.
Yeah, you like reading it with him a little bit and let him ask you questions, because like, I have one part in there. If you take two saucers and put them together, that looks like a flying saucer, right? Yep. And then I tell the kids, but don't try to fly it across the room. So if you hear your china breaking, you will know what happened.
I've got the kind of kid that would be trying that as well. And your book, even before that, we're going back to 2016, was UFOs and Government, A Historical Inquiry. I know that's one you were speaking to Micah Hanks with, who was just on the podcast with me. He holds that, as well as many others, in very high regard. If you give us a snapshot of what that book is about too.
Sure. UFOs and Government, A Historical Inquiry, that is like a college volume book. It's an 8x11. It's 600, almost 600 pages. And it basically goes through the history of the subject and how the government reacted to it from 1945 until the modern era. So it's really for someone who wants an excellent reference book and someone who wants to truly understand the history of the subject. It is not light reading.
So you've got that kind of heavier read, which is what I was going to say about it. I'm glad you did. And you've got a much lighter read aimed at a younger audience. Is it fair to say this new book, UFOs, A Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know, sits in the middle, because the book itself seems to be aimed at newcomers, but also for someone with a long-standing interest in the topic as well?
Right. And that's the way I tried to write the book, Andy, is I tried to write it so that someone who really did not know much about the subject, but an adult, could read it and still get something out of it, as well as those who have studied the subject can get something out of it also. So I really tried to write it for the broader audience, beyond just the people, you know, that study UFOs all the time.
So what was the inspiration for this particular book then?
My inspiration on this book was, I wanted to say, what have I learned after 17 years of studying this subject? And what I point out in the book that I've learned is the UFO phenomenon is real. It's a physical object that exists in our atmosphere, and that it is intelligently controlled. And in the book, I go through how I get to that conclusion, and that whatever controls it is much more advanced technologically than we are. What I say we don't know is, we can't truly know what its origin is or what its intent may be. But we do know that it's not anything created by mankind.
In going through the book and writing it yourself, so obviously you're writing it and putting down what you've learned. Did you learn anything new yourself while writing the book that you kind of went, anything that cropped up, any patterns, anything at all like that?
Yeah, there was something that hit me as I was writing the book, right? And this was the subject in science. We always say, I want to be able to repeat the experiment. I want to be able to do it again. And so I started thinking, well, is that always true? Are we always able to repeat an experiment? And as I thought about it, the answer was no. I mean, I come out of a field of science where you can repeat everything, right? In chemistry, if you mix a certain amount of sodium bicarbonate, which is baking soda, and acetic acid, which is vinegar, and you control the temperature, the rate of the reaction, all of that, it's repeatable. Time after time, you can get it. And that's what people ask for in the world of UFOs, right? There's like, well, can you repeat that? Can you give me a dozen pictures of this disc-shaped object you're talking about? So I started thinking, and there are certain sciences where you can't do that. And so what's unique about those sciences, right? And I started with biology, which is kind of in the middle. It's not a real hard science, but it's not what they call a soft science. So if you were doing an experiment with, let's say, bacteria, you can control that pretty well. If you're doing an experiment with a pack of dogs, and I give a pack of dogs a slice of meat and say, this is how they reacted to me, you could do the same experiment and you may get a different result. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because the dogs have an intelligence to them, right? And not every dog has the same intelligence. So it becomes harder to control the experiment. Then you move that up higher to, let's say, human beings. So you're in the world of psychology and sociology. And now it is even more difficult, right? If you yell a cuss word at one human, you may not get the same reaction out of another human, right?
Yeah.
And so what if you move it to the next level? What if what you're dealing with is even more intelligent than us? Well, now you would expect it to be even more difficult to repeat an experiment. And you even have to wonder, are you even in control of the experiment, right? Because imagine wanting to get repetitive results on something that's much more intelligent than you are.
So you've essentially got the experiment controlling the outcome and deciding itself what they want the outcome to be.
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly right. Because for all you know, you're the experiment, and you have it in reverse.
How do you even begin then to combat that and study this phenomenon on even just the next step up?
I think you still have to do the best you can with science, right? So you document everything, you use the scientific process, but at the same time, you realize that you can't necessarily always duplicate everything. So if you were to take scientific equipment and measure an object, and let's say it emitted a frequency at, let's say, 1.2 gigahertz, well, that doesn't mean the next time you see that object, it's going to emit a frequency at 1.2 gigahertz. It may or it may not. So you just have to bear that in mind while using as much science as you can in the study of it. Then the other thing that you should attempt to do, in my opinion, and I mentioned this in the book, is perhaps attempt to communicate with it, right? Try communication methods. There's nothing to lose, right? At the very worst case, there's no reply, but at least you make the attempt to do that.
In your studies and investigations, what attempts at communication have you came across that have been of any interest to you?
There have been several cases where the object, on an aircraft, you have what they call a transponder. So the aircraft sends out a signal at a certain frequency. And then in the military, you reply to that frequency with another code. Well, there have been cases where UFOs emitted a transponder signal. Of course, the counter argument is, no, it didn't really. That was a reflection, right? It came from somewhere else, didn't come from the UFO. But there does appear to be a likelihood that there have been attempts to send a frequency back. So I think I would emit, various frequencies at UFOs if one shows up. But that's the problem. how do you get one to show up, right? Because it's almost like winning the lottery to see a UFO, at least for me, because I've never seen one myself. But they do seem to be attracted to nuclear sites, right? Whether it's a carrier strike group, like in the case of the USS Nimitz and USS Princeton, or whether it's a nuclear power plant. So if I had unlimited funds, could do anything I wanted, then I would basically have a research ship that tracked a carrier strike group everywhere it went, just waiting for a UFO to show up. So I think that's the best bet. And of course, if you couldn't get that cooperation from the military, then perhaps if you set up your own nuclear site and then try to attract UFOs that way.
I think that comes with its own legalities and issues, doesn't it? Health and safety in 2024.
A lot of legality issues.
And that's quite a common known attraction now, is that nuclear, you know, bait almost. And you've actually stolen one of my questions, because it was, in terms of cases, if money was no object, how would you explore further? But just to expand on that idea then, if you get your, you know, the SS Powell, and you're out there tracking a carrier strike group, just not too far away from it, keeping tabs, you're allowed. UFO shows up, attracted to whatever bait you've got out there. What are the next steps? Is it a case of trying to communicate? Is it observation? Is it seeing if you can do this over and over and over again?
Now, I would be trying to measure everything I could. So I would have a spectrometer to measure all frequencies that it might be potentially emitting. I would be emitting frequencies towards the UFO, and I would be using laser systems to try to communicate with it also, and basically hoping for a reply.
We mentioned earlier the value of anecdotal evidence, and this is something that comes across within the book as well. Expand on that for me, because for many folks, the frustration with the UFO topic is only having anecdotal evidence. For you then, what is that value in just having, for example, one source to a story?
Yeah, so if you just have one person's testimony, or maybe just two people's testimony at a certain point in time, that's anecdotal evidence. And it doesn't have as much weight unless you have hundreds of people over decades of time. And it's actually not hundreds, it's thousands of people who have reported on UFOs. So some people say, well, that's not science. We don't use anecdotal evidence in science. Actually, we do use anecdotal evidence in science if you have a large enough amount of data that's anecdotal. A good example is the FDA. When you qualify a new drug, let's say you have a new type of painkiller, well, the way they qualify that painkiller is they give it to 5,000 individuals, and those individuals rate their pain on a scale of 1 to 10, and then they re-rate it based on how they felt after they took the drug. Mm-hmm. So we use anecdotal evidence all the time. I give an interesting example in the book. When if you had cancer and you go into surgery, and the surgeon is going to remove cancerous tissue from you, and you're asleep now, and as he begins to cut, this is anecdotal evidence that he's looking at. This is purely what he sees with his eyes, and him making a decision: is this possibly cancerous, not cancerous? Should I take it out, not take it out? And he's making those decisions on the fly. It's anecdotal evidence based on his experience, just like a pilot is providing anecdotal evidence on their experience as they're flying. So we're okay with that. But if that same surgeon walks outside, sees a UFO 50 feet above him and says, hey, I saw this disc. It couldn't be more than 50 feet away. It was huge. And it was just sitting there in the sky, and then suddenly it took off, and in 2 seconds it was gone. Well, now we say, oh, well, that's anecdotal evidence. We're not going to count that. We're not considering it at all. And the reality is you should consider it. It is evidence because we are a type of data gathering equipment, right? You have eyes that gather it at certain wavelengths. You have ears that gather sound at certain wavelengths. And you have a brain, which is like the computer, that remembers things. And of course, the difference is our mind memories can change, right? So we're a little different from a computer. But to give an example, if you were in a car wreck, you may not remember the exact color of the car that hit you. You may not recall the exact time that it struck you. And you may not even remember exactly were you perfectly in your lane when, you know, when that accident happened. But there's one thing that you do remember, and that is that you were in a car wreck. There's no doubt about that, right? Whether or not you have any physical injuries or not, your brain remembers you were in a car wreck. Same thing with a UFO sighting. There's no doubt that you saw this large object near you. I'm not talking about someone who sees lights in the sky or something far away. I'm talking about witnesses who say there was a disc-shaped object and it was no more than 100 feet from me. Well, that person saw that. Now, you can argue, was that disc 100 feet across or 200 feet across or 50 feet across? But there's no doubt that he saw something that was non-terrestrial, that was shaped like a disc.
I think my wife would agree with you that we can have the same conversation and hear two different things from that same conversation as well. So it turns out she's normally right. And I love your example, though, of the surgeon and that anecdotal evidence, but the same surgeon on his lunch break could look up and see that UFO. And within the book, you discuss many things, including the psychological and sociological aspects of the UFO phenomenon, media bias, media perception. As it stands in 2024, what is the biggest aspect of, you know, society that's stigmatizing the conversation? Is it media perception that's causing that public stigma still?
The media definitely causes a stigma, and the media is what created this stigma back in the 1940s and 1950s, because media wants to dramatize. They want something interesting to get people to listen to. So they either want to say, you know, John Doe has a picture of a gray alien, or they want to say Arrow has said there are no aliens, right? They want something dramatic. And so as a result, they look for the wildest and craziest statements that they can find on either side of the subject. And so this causes a stigma in the study of UFOs.
You know, we're talking about the future of UFO research, and you suggest, again, within the book, to move forward, scientists, government agencies, civilian researchers, there's got to be a level of collaboration. But this is something I struggle with, given where we are as a society. Is that collaboration likely? You're talking about a subject which now, if we're going back to Roswell around about the end of the Second World War, you've got 80 years of secrecy, 80 years of deception, misinformation. How do you recommend we start to bring all those groups together to study this? And again, to go back to the example, we've got a lot of illnesses and disease on this planet, even things like poverty. If everyone came together at that level, they would all be gone. You could get rid of those within weeks, you know, but it doesn't happen because of how we are as a species. So how do you suggest we bring everyone together that we could study this phenomenon more appropriately?
So I think the best way to bring people together actually is money. I think if Congress, for example, in the various nations of the world, their legislative bodies, were to appropriate funding for the study of UAP or UFOs, then that will attract people who have an interest in it to begin the study. The problem with military groups, and here's the big difference between science on one hand and the military on the other. The military has to operate in closed information circles, right? Information's hidden, it's closed, it's kept away. So I think the only way to move forward is with openness, right? Which means you have to have purely scientific endeavors where the military is not even involved. And that's the way to get to the answer, because otherwise it will always be closed information. And then I kind of look at it, Andy, also just look down the road. Let's look 50 years from now, 100. Whenever the day comes that we make contact with another intelligence, whenever that day occurs, the question is, do you want your first contact with another intelligence to be made by a military organization or to have it made by a civilian scientific-based organization? I think the latter is my preference. I would not want first contact to be via a military organization.
No, and I can see the benefits. In my head, I've got Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that sort of scenario. I've also got Mars Attacks and Independence Day, where you've got the military side of things, guns start being fired, missiles go off. It's an interesting one to discuss. Again, I've just been going back and listening to some audiobooks as I've been doing some traveling back and forward, listening to After Disclosure, AD, Bryce Abel and Richard Dolan co-authored that book. Some interesting notions at the start of that, again, as to how that would come about, those early days of disclosure, the discussions, how it might happen. Recommended for anyone who's not aware of it or checked that one out. Robert, I want to just finish off on some listener questions, if you don't mind. Got a lot through for you. I'll cut them down as best I can. The first one from Stephen over on Patreon. So thanks, Stephen. He says, Robert, many UFO enthusiasts like to point to the dozens of stories of UFO encounters over decades as evidence of the phenomenon. However, individual stories, no matter how credible or detailed, don't count as scientific evidence. Can you describe what would count as evidence in terms of science, something that would convince your average critical scientist? And I wonder, is that similar to what you're saying about anecdotal evidence and the volume of it?
Well, yes, the volume of anecdotal evidence is one. But the other is we have radar data, right? In the Stephenville case, we have radar data that indicates, and this is the raw data. We also have radar data in the JAL Japan Airlines case of 1986. We also have radar data from 1968, which involved a B-52, which captured a UFO on radar as it was moving around the plane. And there's an excellent paper written by a Frenchman, Dr. Claude Poher. He was at one time the head of GIPON, who looked at the acceleration values using that radar data. And he also, I believe his value was somewhere over 200 G-forces. So we have more than just anecdotal data. But the thing is, when you look at individual cases one by one, in what your listener is referring to, you can always come up with some reason to try to explain a case, right? But the problem becomes you just start lining up one case after another, trying to come up with reasons to explain every case. And sometimes the likelihood of the reasons, right, are so rare that it's hard to accept those as justifications to explain the case. And the Nimitz case is a good example where I've talked to individuals who, you know, have explanations. Okay, we can't depend on what the radar operators remember that they saw, to, well, the planes which went out based on radar data, and they see a target where they got, well, that was a coincidence. It just so happened there was an object where the radar sent them to, right? And then that the objects disappeared in 2 seconds. Well, maybe they didn't really. Maybe the pilots just imagined. So they start building, you know, unlikely event on top of unlikely event until finally the overall explanation is nearly impossible.
The second question is about repeatability. And again, that was from Stephen, and you've answered that exactly before when we discussed it. So thank you, Stephen, for those questions. Peter asks, and Peter sent me this question quite a few times, and I've always either left it out or forgot to ask it. So Peter asks, does Robert have any demographics that show a bias by the phenomenon, either for witnesses or abductees towards different cohorts of people, for example, race, skin color, neurodiversity, predisposition to inherited conditions, etc.?
So to that question, if you're talking about abductions, that's, I separate that from people who see physical objects and there's no abduction involved.
He said either or, just so you know, just in case you missed that, but witness right. or abductee.
So, either or, yeah. Right. So in terms of abductions, I think there is a higher likelihood of certain personality types reporting an abduction. That doesn't mean abductions don't happen, but there is a probably psychological component to abductions. In the case of just physical objects that are seen in the sky, I've found no indication of any personality types, sex, anything else. I mean, they occur all over the world. All sorts of people see them.
Follow-up from Peter. He asks, there's plenty of evidence that UAP exist and a strong suggestion that they're extraterrestrial. Is there any evidence for you as to why they are here and what they might be doing?
So I agree with Peter's two points in the beginning as to why they are here and what they might be doing is pure speculation. I mean, it could be anything from they're just passing through, curious to what's here, to who knows, someone running their own sociology experiment. Let's go to planet Earth. I'm going to write my paper on those guys. You know, who knows? There's just no way to know why they're here.
If it was for fun speculation, and for example, Chris Mellon has speculated himself on, for example, black triangle UFOs. He believes they're mapping or scanning the Earth planet for some reason. And he comes from what most people would assume is a place of at least some kind of knowledge or insider knowledge, which would be safe to assume. If I put you on the spot and just ask purely speculative, do you have something that you think, as a scientist, this would make sense to me?
For myself, I would suspect curiosity is the main reason that they would be here. I don't think they need our resources. There's nothing that we could provide. So the only thing I can think of is just, you know, it's their curiosity that drives them here. And then if I had to speculate also, I would speculate there's more than one origin to these. I don't think there's a single origin, because there's just too much difference in some of the craft that are that people have seen.
I would agree with that. I wonder then, do you think, say tomorrow, Robert, we discover interstellar travel, there's a breakthrough overnight, we discover it and we've got some craft that we can jet off into the solar system, the galaxy and the wider universe. Do you think as a species, we would explore any differently? I wonder if you were in a craft with, you know, with Rich Hoffman and a few other academics and maybe some military personnel had to be along for the ride with you. You pull up to planet K-12 or K-218b, which has just been, you know, James Webb's having a look at. How would you go about an observation and would it look any different?
I would think the first thing we would do is try to look, you know, to gather all the data we could to say which planet is most likely habitable and has life on it. And those would be the ones we would go visit first. The problem, if we obtained interstellar travel at this point in time, is that I don't think you would consider the human race a benevolent species. We're No. more of an aggressive species. And that might garner some attention if we were to suddenly develop that capability. I don't know that the rest of the universe would welcome us.
But I wonder, say we planet hop Jetsons style, okay? So you're in a craft, you pull up and you find a planet and yep, there's life. You can see the night lights, the street lights, whatever. Do you think we would do much different as a species right now other than observe, hover at a great distance, mill about, you know, is that what we would do?
I think if we were a benevolent species, right, and some of humanity is benevolent, they would say, let's hover, let's stay back, let's just observe, we should not interfere. However, I think there's a tendency in our species that we would want to interfere. We would want to explore that planet, maybe put a settlement on that planet and continue from there. So unfortunately, I don't think we would simply stand off and observe.
Message from Christian. He asks, and he sent a couple of questions. Christian, little bit's been answered elsewhere, so I'll jump to this one. How do you think, Robert, we potentially study something that could be so far ahead of us when you start to dig into this rationally, and rational thinking doesn't really apply anymore, and things don't make sense? And on top of that, you have an effort from certain parties to muddy the waters. And Christian suggests lack of funding is by design. And he wonders, have you noticed any, you know, shenanigans, as he says, great word, Christian, by the government to perhaps, you know, hold funding back, hack MUFON, hack SCU?
Yeah, that, you know, it's hard to know for certain, right? Is someone hacking you? Is someone interfering? There's no way to know for certain on that. So, you know, that's a difficult question to answer. I'm not sure that I can give him a good answer on that.
Have you ever had any kind of instances then in 17 years of anything that you've suspected as being foul play, you know, things being interfered with, being thrown off the scent, not to get conspiratorial, but, you know, people deliberately trying to sabotage stuff you're trying to do?
Well, I know that you definitely don't get answers to your Freedom of Information requests. So, I mean,
some people do.
Yeah, some people will get some answers, but it's difficult to get answers on Freedom of Information requests. And usually when you get an interesting answer, a good answer, it's often by accident. You know, someone happens to, you know, give out a document that perhaps they did not intend to give out. I don't know. But then you also have to consider, well, maybe the document was given out intentionally for some subversive reason, right? So all of this fuels the conspiracy theories, right? Because the more the government hides information, the more it fuels conspiracy. And that's part of the problem, is that the government makes it so difficult to get information. And I don't agree with most of the reasons, which are, you know, sources and methods need to be protected for national security. I'll give you an example of radar data, right? You have, we've put out information, for example, on the speed of a North Korean ICBM that was launched. Yet we can't give the speed of a UFO that was flying through the atmosphere that was picked up on radar, because that gives away sources and methods. Well, the reality is it doesn't give away sources and methods unless you see the raw data and how the data is collected. But the output of a radar system is not top secret information. So the speed is not secret.
No, that's fair. There are a few individuals in the community that do seem to have a lot of luck when it comes to FOIA requests. I'm sure there's a large part of that is skill, but there is also some folks who would suggest that maybe they're being told where to look, which also would be very helpful, I'm sure, if people like yourself are, you know, told, oh, there's some really interesting radar data. If you look for or ask for exactly this, you will get it. But I suppose you have to have the right friends to get access to that kind of information, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, with radar data, that's something most people don't ask for. And today, radar data is very difficult to get. And the thing is, if anyone gets radar data, for example, if John Greenwald were to get radar data, I can analyze that radar data. So that is data which is good scientific data that anyone can utilize if it's released.
John is very good at what he does, that's for sure. Last listener question, because I want to very quickly finish off talking about the conference coming up at the end of May for SCU. Question was from Critters16. Getting people prepared and comfortable with a dramatic change is a large challenge. How does Robert suggest we go about getting the wider public prepared?
I don't think that any type of disclosure will happen anytime soon. And as a matter of fact, whenever disclosure happens, I think the disclosure will come from the UFO end, not from our end. Okay. I don't see disclosure ever coming from our end of the table.
Are you thinking then some kind of like mass sighting a la Phoenix Lights, but in 2024?
I would think it would basically require the UFOs to communicate directly with humankind if there was going to be a disclosure. I don't think that, I'm not convinced how much the government truly knows about the UFO subject. I go back and forth between they know something versus they're not smart enough to be paying attention to it. They're just ignoring it. So I go back and forth between those two.
Yeah, I've got a pretty fluid opinion on a lot of this. I think I've settled quite happily on that the government know a lot more than they let on, but a lot less than we probably expect that they know.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
And when I say the government is hundreds of thousands of employees spread right out throughout the world. It's probably a very, very, very small group of folks who have access to what we would want to know, if you want to put it that way. But yeah, really interesting. Robert, listen, you've been wonderful with your time. Just before we finish up, SCU has its conference, its annual conference at the end of May, and that's the AAPC, which is the Anomalous Aerospace Phenomena Conference in Huntsville, Alabama, 31st of May till the 2nd of June. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I believe you're hosting, aren't you?
Yes. And an important thing for everyone to know about this conference is that we have live streaming. And you're actually able to ask questions. You don't have to be physically at the conference. You can do it from your living room couch. And we already have people attending the conference from most of the countries in Europe, as well as some countries in South America and Australia and New Zealand. So there are a lot of people that are attending, and you can actually meet these other people, even though they're from other countries. And because we actually have like get-togethers where the computer program mixes you up with other individuals and you sit at a table and discuss it, even though, you know, you're remote, but it's all live stream.
I really need to try and get to one of these. I'm hoping to get to something this year, but a little bit later in the year. But I know several former podcast guests are taking part. I've just pulled it up here. We've got Kevin Knuth, who's just been on the podcast recently. Ross Coulthart's a keynote speaker, very popular. Micah Hanks is on there. You've got Beatrice Villarreal, who's coming on the podcast very, very soon. There's a lot of great speakers. And what does an event like this offer? Because this is obviously the scientific side of things, isn't it? You've got a lot of events which have a purpose that happen out there. You know, people love their contact in the desert and all that kind of stuff. That's potentially a different conversation to what you're going to see at an AAPC. Is that fair?
Yeah, yes, it is. So this will be more science-based, but for example, we will be taught, myself and another colleague will be discussing work we've done that indicates the most common shapes of the UFO and UAP objects. So such as the disc and the triangle. So we actually have drawings with measurements and approximations of ratios of these craft that we will be presenting at the conference. And then, of course, as you mentioned, Beatrice will be talking about astronomical imagery that she has collected over the years. And Kevin Knuth's are always very interesting. And he talks about the possibility of interstellar space travel. So there's a lot of information given that you don't have to be a scientist to understand. So it's we do it in a way that hopefully anyone can enjoy the conference.
Absolutely. And I welcome more of these types of organizations, events, Galileo, SCU. I've got my next guest after yourself, Robert, is Dr. Gary Nolan joining me back on the podcast. So we'll be talking about Sol and this, again, continuing that scientific focus in the UFO conversation over the coming weeks. I've got John Tedesco, who's talking about his UFO research on the East Coast of New York and more. So really focusing in on that scientific endeavor. Listen, to finish off, Robert, how can people get a hold of your work, contact you? Obviously, the latest book, UFOs, A Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know.
Right. So the best way to get in touch, for example, on the conference is go to explorescu.org. And they can also send a message there, and they can contact me through SCU. So if they go there and send an email, I will get it. And then on Amazon, they can find the book just by Googling my name, Robert Powell, and the word UFOs, and those books will show up.
All of those links will also be in the description for this podcast as well. Robert, do you know what? It's a slight on me that I've taken so long to get you on the podcast. I should have done this some time ago. And I'd love to get you back on in the near future, talk about the AAPC, how it went, and the great work that SCU are doing with you and Rich and others.
Well, thanks, Andy. I enjoyed being on your podcast. I look forward to doing it again sometime.
Certainly will. Thanks again for your time, Robert.
All right. Thanks. Bye, Andy.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show out on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium, YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little rain. Meditative game of stateful on meta. Can't imagine how it could have been any better. I got to the top of the stairs and there he was. Like, you awake? I was about to abduct you, cuz. I jumped back and nearly kissed myself. Then I climbed out the window after the elf. And I woke up in my bed and there was something on my head. And everything was weird and everything was red. And I called up my boys. They thought this was noise. They thought it was a dream. They thought it was my toys. They thought it was my problems. And they think I should see therapy. And I don't know what to do because it doesn't really scare me. If you really want to know who I think I'd be, I think it's you and me and us and we and him and her and that and she and that thing over there and what's that, Jane? But for being serious, open your mind, consider your heart, consider time, consider your space, consider your lies, consider your life, consider your eyes. It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, PayLater, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.